So today's talk will be on the power of silence. I'm not going to get away with that one. Instead, I did yesterday to talk about how all this meditation so far leads to insight and understanding of things. And I did give a little hint last night. And first of all, I don't know, I'm very sensitive to you. Sometimes I wonder if I go too deep, a bit too challenging. But please understand that at this retreat, there are people who are coming for the very first time. There will be people coming for years. And so sometimes you have to do the basic stuff, sometimes the advanced stuff, sometimes in the middle. So we try and give like a buffet for everybody. So if there's some things which you think is a bit, ooh, that's a bit much for me, that's fine, no need to take it. And the things which you can understand, understand it. And those of you who, when I start to talk about the start of meditation, ordinary stuff, you think, oh, I just want the more advanced stuff, please understand that there are other people who haven't been coming to as many retreats as you. So that's why I have to try and find a balance there. And sometimes you go to one end, sometimes the other end, to give a full buffet service of meditation and Buddhism and stuff. But in today, I wanted to, again, focus on the insight practice, and I gave a little description in brief about what we mean by delusion in Buddhism, avijja, sometimes said ignorance, not seeing things as they truly are, the lack of wisdom. And number one, people always argue what is wisdom, what isn't wisdom, what's true and what's not true. And arguing is not really going to get you anywhere. And in fact, you know in life that people, both of them think they're totally right, and they're on opposite ends of the spectrums of view. And you wonder, how on earth can we deal with that? And just for those people who haven't heard this before, I say this every time I do a marriage service. You say, because if you have a partner in life, and if you have a disagreement with that partner, please do not argue. You are wasting your time. Even if you are the top lawyer in Australia, and you can get criminals off their charges because you are such a great debater, you will never be able to win an argument with your partner. No way in the world. Even the best arguments, even Nobel laureate people, cannot defeat their wife or their husband in an argument. You're wasting your time. You've seen that before? You've got it all right. You know you've got it all right. You've got all your facts there, and you present it, you know, to your partner, and say no. So I think a few people are understanding what I'm talking about. You can't argue with your partner. So instead of arguing and wasting time, you won't be able to convince your partner that they are wrong. But you still have to move on. You have to make some sort of decision. And it has to be a fair decision. So that's why that we've invented what we call the calendar method for solving disputes. It's very fair, brilliant, and simple. And the calendar method works like this. You have an argument with your partner, and you can't make up your mind together who's right and who's wrong, and you've got to act on something, then look at the calendar. Find out what day of the month it is. And if it is an odd number, the girl is right. If it's an even number, the man is right. If you're in a gay relationship, it does not work. But at least for most relationships, it works. Which means you look at it, what day is it today anyway? Anyone know? 28. So the guys are right today. Yeah. But be careful, guys, because tomorrow the girls are right. So what it means, number one, it's fair. Because one of the terrible things with arguments is, you know, you always want it to be fair. Why is he always has to be right? Why does she always get her own way? So it makes it fair, even. And because people are smart, you've probably already figured out that in that scheme of things, the girl gets a few extra light days a year over the men. But it's worth it, guys, just for a bit of peace and quiet. And it means you don't have to argue, you don't have to debate, you don't have to get all your evidence and try to convince the other partner. The calendar does the convincing for you, makes a decision. It doesn't matter what decision it is, honestly. When people have been asking me about making decisions in the interviews, it doesn't really matter in life whether you turn left or you turn right. What does matter is after you've turned left, then what do you do? Once you've chosen the right fork in the road, are you going to make that decision work? Decisions themselves are not the final judge of happiness and suffering. It's what you do after you make the decision, where you really make it work, or whether you just get lax and just assume it's going to work. So that means I don't mind what decisions you make. Decision to do this and do that, it's what we do afterwards, that's the most important. So that means it doesn't have to work, it's not that important, honestly. But what really is important, you have some fairness and respect for one another and some peace in this world. And that's the same, sometimes you argue about Dhamma, you argue about who's right and who's wrong, and this is where people get really, really crazy. And they're using no insight at all. So the first example of insight, that it comes from the old Zen story of the two monks. They noticed on a windy morning like this morning, there was a flag fluttering on the top of the flagpole. And one of the monks said, "Ah, the flag is moving." And the other one said, "No, the wind is moving." And they had an argument, because it doesn't matter how senior or wise you are, you cannot settle the argument. So then they went to their master, and the master replied, "It wasn't the wind moving, it wasn't the flag moving, your mind was moving." And they weren't satisfied with that. So then they went to the Theravada forest Ajahn, the whole three of them, the Zen master and the two monks. And they related the story. And the first monk said, "It was the flag moving." The other said, "No, the wind was moving." And the master said, "No, it was the mind which was moving." And they were arguing together, and the Ajahn said, "Your problem is, your mouths are moving." And that was the end of the argument. So, that is insight. It's your mouths are moving. That causes a problem. So, shut up. And then you can have a very peaceful life. Just like there's a couple, oh, I haven't seen them for a while now. Many years ago, it was a Thai lady married to an Australian man. And the Thai girl could not speak a word of English and wasn't interested in learning. And the Thai man couldn't, sorry, the Australian man could not speak any Thai, and he refused to learn. So she could understand what he was saying, and he could understand what she was saying. And they were so much in love, had perfect harmony and peace in their house. That is the secret of a happy relationship. At least it worked. So there's something to be seen there. So, but anyway, if you can understand each other, please understand the important thing is, you know, is being in harmony and peace together, not being right. So these are simple insights which actually stops arguments. And especially when we start talking about insight and Dhamma and the truth, that's why I see Buddhists have these huge arguments. What's right and what's wrong? And it gets something wrong there somewhere. So if you are developing some insight, it has to be quite personal. And don't think the way you see the world is the way that other people are going to see the world. Just the same that what food you like. You know, you might think that this food is the best, and other people might think some other food is the best. Some people just might like this type of meditation, and you go and tell other people, this is the best meditation, this is the greatest. But other people aren't the same. You see, a lot of times, you know, what works for you doesn't work for other people. And that's the same as, you know, your truth, your insights. So if you do have insights, don't go banging other people over the head with them, especially your best friend or your partner. and trying to enlighten them. You're wasting your time. And also, you're not really seeing what's really going on. So first of all, keep your insights pretty personal. And you know if they are insights. You can test their veracity, their truth, by the effect they have on you. Do they make you a more peaceful person? A happier person? A person who can live in harmony with others with ease? Or does it separate you? And does it make you more afraid of other people? Does it make you just more unhappy? If it is, it cannot be insight. It cannot be truth. Because you should know that one of the, well, not one, but some of the features of insight is its effect on your body and speech. If you really understand the truth of things, you never do anything which hurts another or harms another person. You just can't do that. It doesn't make any sense at all. It's just like being a Buddhist as a young man. I used to go to the temple. I went to quite a few temples, but the Thai temple was closest. And I used to go there and listen to the talks and do some meditation. And it happened that after some time, one of the monks took me aside and said, "Seeing you've been coming here a long time, it's about time you took the 5 Buddhist precepts." And quite honestly, I replied to that monk, "Well, what are the precepts? No one's ever told me those before." And so they told me, not killing any living being. And at that time, I was a vegetarian. I said, "I don't even eat meat." So, "Oh, very good." And not stealing. I don't steal. When I was a school kid, I always thought if the conductor on the bus in London didn't ask for your fare, it was his fault, I didn't need to pay. But when you started meditating, you felt wrong about that. You felt that was not right. And there was something inside of you. So sometimes I go up to the conductor at the end of the journey and said, "You didn't ask me for the fare, here it is." And he'd be quite surprised. And said, I can't steal anymore. I can't do it. Committing adultery. He said, "Look, I've got a girlfriend. And quite frankly, one girlfriend is all you can afford at that age." In fact, it was more than you can afford, probably. They're really expensive. But anyway, that's what I remember anyway. Because, I was a poor guy, poor student. Didn't have much. But anyway. No adultery, or just once enough. Lying. Again, even lying. Every time you did sort of tell a lie, you felt you'd let somebody down, and you let yourself down as well. Never felt right to tell a lie to deceive another person. And lastly, just alcohol. And I'd given up drinking alcohol at university. I remember one of my cousins, as soon as I told him, he said, "You won't last. You won't last a year, so you bet £1. He still owes me." But anyway, I told him, "Look, I keep the 5 precepts." "Oh, really? So you don't need to take them. Thank you. Bye-bye." And it was the insight into, the keeping a good life and how happy it is. It was that which gave me the ability just to naturally, at ease, without worrying about it, without feeling you're superior to other people. Just you did it because it's an obvious thing to do. It's your lifestyle. That became my precepts. And even like right speech, I was telling a few people the other day that, one of the worst things, one of the worst precepts you can break. You know what it is? I'll tell you in a story. Because apparently I told this to Ajahn Brahmani, and he hadn't heard this for years. This was 4 Catholic priests. I'm not anything against Christianity, but it works with Catholic priests, this story. It doesn't really quite work with Buddhist monks. These 4 Catholic priests were at a seminar just for the clergy. And at lunchtime, they're sitting at the same table. They were friends for many years. And they'd just been to a lecture on confessions. That's a big thing in the Catholic Church. It's a very wonderful thing to do. You can go and say anything, to this person on the other side of the room. Just really open up your heart and just get it off your chest. So, one of the priests said, "That was a brilliant talk on confessions this morning." "Yeah, it really was." And one of the priests, just looked down and said, "I really need to tell someone about this." He said, I'm very embarrassed and ashamed that someone in my position has actually done this. And he said he was an alcoholic. Because they have this wine at all the services. He said, any wine which is left, I drink it until the bottle's empty. And on a Monday, I go to the bottle shop, I get whiskey, rum, vodka, and by the afternoon, I'm totally drunk. He said, I'm an alcoholic. And the other priest didn't realize he'd hid it so well. He said, that's terrible that someone in your position who tells other people to be good. You're supposed to be leading by example, a moral authority. And you all drink so much alcohol, that's terrible. But at least you tell us and let us know. That's a good thing. And then the next priest looked at the table and said, okay, suppose I should tell you my biggest sin. And he said, that is gambling. Sometimes, you know, I sort of go incognito into the casino. I bet online. I bet on horse racing, on tennis, on elections. I bet even on the length of a sermon. I bet on everything. I'm just a gambling addict. And I've lost so much money, you know, I owe the church a lot of money. I said, that's even worse than alcoholism. You're gambling. And again, you're supposed to be getting up there every Sunday and inspiring and leading other people to live good lives. That's terrible, being a gambler. And they asked, at least, you know, you let us know. Maybe we can do something about it. And then the third priest, he didn't want to say at all what his worst sin was. And it took him a few minutes to get it out of him. And he said, oh, there is a woman in my congregation. We've been having an affair. And she's married. It's adultery. But we're in love. I can't stop myself. And the other priest looked to him, adultery? As a celibate priest? That's terrible. We never suspected anyone like you would sink to such a level. That's terrible. But at least you confessed. Well done. And then they looked to the fourth priest. And he said, don't ask me. And then, come on, you can tell us. He said, no, you don't want to know. Said, why? They said, it cannot be worse than alcoholism, gambling, or adultery. And the priest said, it is worse. It's much worse. Believe me, don't ask me. But they wouldn't let him go until he let them know what his biggest sin was. And then finally they got it out of him. He said, I'm someone who can't keep a secret. I'm a gossip. The other priests, they wanted to throttle him. All their sins would get around very quickly. So the worst sin, the worst breaking of precepts is not alcoholism, adultery, or gambling. It's gossiping. So it's very nice. Instead of gossiping, one of the beautiful things which you learn through insight is never saying bad things about another person. Always saying nice things about them. Praising them. And I remember someone saying that even testing you out, say something nice about, say, Adolf Hitler. And they said he was a leader in his field. You can always say something nice about everybody. And isn't that better than saying something rotten about them? Because when you say something nice about a person, especially the ones you live with, you're actually, whatever you're saying something nice about, you're encouraging, and it becomes more prevalent in them. And I've seen this certainly in Bodhinyana Monastery, as the monks here will let you know. Yeah, they've all got faults. I've got faults too. But whenever you see a monk, you always don't look at the faults, you praise a good part of them. And I call that watering the flowers, not watering the weeds. An incredible thing happens. If you just look at the nice part and praise the nice part, don't do this terrible gossip thing, praising the nice part of a person, that actually grows and increases. And you get much better monks that way. You criticize people, put them down, point out all their faults, and the faults grow. water the weeds grow. And that's what I have noticed through insight into looking at my own mind, meditating. All the times I fall asleep, I don't worry about those. But the times you have beautiful nimittas, well done, Ajahn Brahm. The time you get really nice meditation, well done, yes, good on you. That is encouraging the good qualities. So the insight which you get from meditation, you put into life. The insights of life you put into meditation. So far, how's your meditation been? Brilliant. You're all so incredibly amazing meditators. We say, well, but I've been falling asleep all the time. Every time you've been chanting, I've been arguing with you about how stupid chanting is. You can't even know what it is. Every time you do the big sadhus, oh God, what's he doing with his big sadhus all the time? Every time I've been meditating, I've just been having my sexual fantasies. Every time I've gone back after the evening talk, I've been sneaking bread and stuff out of the kitchen to eat in my room. You know what I say to you? Very good. Well done. Because that's building you up. It's not criticizing you. And you find if you build a person up, praise them, if you focus on the beautiful meditations you've had so far, and the bad ones, you put on a piece of toilet paper and you flush away. If you keep the beautiful stuff, that encourages you, motivates you. And amazingly, you think, wow, I may be able to be a good meditator. Maybe I can do this. Maybe I am okay. And that simple little bit of insight really empowers you. As I mentioned, I think, yesterday, when I was young, some traditions, they were really critical of lay people. Say, oh, you can't get enlightened. I felt that too. In a place like Thailand, you're a Westerner. Oh, you don't know what Buddhism is about. No way can you get enlightened. But we challenged that. You had a few people, like an Ajahn Chah, said, no, you've got two legs, you can cross them, you've got two arms, you can actually fold them, you can sit straight, you can close your eyes, you've got a breath, you can watch it. Why not? So, we could do that. So we had a few people who had confidence in us. And when you've got a teacher or a guide who has confidence in you, who tells you, yes, you can do it, and you believe them, then you find you do it. So that gives you an understanding of some of the teachings which I'm giving here. High teachings, because I think you can do it. I know you can do it. And then you do it. That little bit of inspiration and uplift. You never say rotten things about one another. So for goodness sake, if that's all you learn on this retreat, when you go home to the people you live with, the people you work with, don't go pointing out each other's faults. No, you know your faults already. Just point out the beautiful parts, the stuff which inspires you, the stuff which you love and respect. Point that out. And they have these beautiful relationships which actually uplifts everybody. So, whatever bad meditations you've had, in the bin. The good meditations, keep them. And inspire yourself. Yeah, you can do it. And so we don't argue. We inspire one another. We uplift. Have you ever found that when lots of people are meditating together, that is inspiring and makes your meditation even better? You can find, this is one of the reasons why I'm asking you, in order to get your own wisdom, not just listen to me, or not read it from books, but to get your own wisdom, when it comes to the practice of meditation, peace, happiness, whatever you wish to look for, what makes that meditation better? What makes it more peaceful? What improves it? And over the days, you know, you can find out exactly maybe the right time. Maybe it's a cup of tea. Maybe you have too much coffee and you're all over the place. Where you sit, how you sit. Maybe have a shower beforehand. Maybe you sit in your hut or you sit on your in the hall here. Maybe you sit outside in the forest. What actually works for you? Because you have to learn that. That's insight. What works? When it works? Because a lot of time people waste a lot of time just trying to do what other people do. Trying to fit in. trying to believe. If you really want to get deep meditation, you have to sit on the floor. You have to hold your hands like this, not like this. Not like this, not like this. You've got to have hands and your back has got to be really straight. So the energy, the chi can rise right up. And you've got to... People actually believe that. And that, please excuse me, that is gomayang. That is bullshit. All that sort of stuff. But why do you do that? It's because you believe what other people tell you, rather than going from your own experience, your own insights. From the mindfulness gives you feedback, you feel what works for you. When you feel what works for you, how long you should you sit for? How much effort? How much letting go? How much kindness? You work it out for yourself. That is insight practice. You feel it for yourself. And you don't give a damn what other people think of you. Because if you follow other people, you'll just be like them. And you'll stunt your own natural growth. There's no two trees in this forest look exactly the same. They all grow in their own way. And that's what makes the forest beautiful. So don't follow other people. Just be mindful, find out what works for yourself. And at each stage of this meditation path, you learn so much. One of the greatest things you're learning is the secret of happiness. What is the meaning of life? The meaning of life is the search for happiness, for fulfillment, in the deepest meaning of the word for happiness. That's the meaning of life. People search for happiness in all sorts of different ways. You know, through relationships, through travel, through success in the field of work, through raising children, building monasteries, wherever you feel you're going to get some happiness and some sense of achievement, fulfillment, whatever it is. Research for that. But again, people go through their whole lives never realizing what happiness truly is. I remember doing this marriage for this couple once, and just after the marriage, the lady said something which was unforgettable. Said, "My marriage day is supposed to be the happiest day of my life." And she said, "Is this it? Is this the happiest? Oh my God." Because she believed what everyone told her. Your marriage, the happiest day of your life. And then, but she questioned it. Well, actually, this is not that good. So if this is the best, this is going to be a terrible time afterwards. But of course, it's not. You know, we just believe these things rather than investigate these things. What is actual happiness? And that is one of the great things which meditation gives you. Number one, you're still enough to be able to look and see what happiness is. And also, the type of meditation you're doing here gets you into so many different types of happinesses which many people just don't know even exists. That's why people are really... who haven't got any idea what meditation is, think you are all absolutely crazy. It's so hard to get a week off work. And you tell people, what did you do on your holiday? Yeah, I got up at 4 o'clock every morning. I couldn't have any dinner. No wine with the meals. And we just sat and walked and no movies, no TV. Is that it? Is that your holiday? You're crazy. You go somewhere interesting, like Bali or the Maldives. Go to see the Great Wall of China. Go and experience things. Go and push your boundaries. Go to these places where you go upside down, whitewater rafting, go trekking in the Himalayas. All those sorts of things. And what do? Just nothing. Just sat here for 7 days, 9 days. For many people, you tell them how you spent your holidays. And many people think you really, really should go and see a psychologist. But there's something else which they really feel really weird. They see you're happy. They can see it. Sometimes you can't because you're not aware enough. Other people can. During the range retreat, 3 months, we allow a dozen people to stay here for the whole 3 months. But it's very hard to get in, even harder to get in than on one of my retreats. But I remember this one lady in the middle of the retreat, 6 weeks of meditation, she was getting bored. and a bit restless. So you know what I did? I did this wonderful, skillful means. I sent her into Armadale Shopping Centre to get some things for China Grove. It wasn't to get some things for China Grove. I wanted her to see how much progress she'd made. And she came back, "That's crazy in the shopping centre. That is just a big headache. People are running around. They're crazy out there. They're mad. There's all this useless stuff and these smells and these sounds. Oh, it's madness there." I said, "But that's where you used to hang out before you started coming on this retreat. You have made progress." And she actually saw that she had made huge progress, but she hadn't noticed it. Because the 6th week, she had nothing to compare her progress with. And that's when you go back, you find that other people, the ones you live with, notice you've changed. You can't see it, because everyone's been changing roughly at the same rate while you're here. When you go back, "Ooh, that's really going to hurt you when you get outside. Wow, it's so fast and so stupid and crazy." So you do get somewhere. You're getting some insight into what happiness is. And sometimes there are even little things like not talking. Yeah, you know, you haven't been keeping your noble status perfectly. You've been chatting about all sorts of stuff. But you talk much less than you would in your normal life. And is it a problem at all? It's actually beautiful. You can have 60 people living together without saying hardly a word. You have your lunch in silence, and the lunch is more delicious. You don't have to speak. And you can still love one another and care for one another without speaking. And you sometimes realize just how much of a waste of time speech is. And how happy is silence. You get up in the morning, and you've got the sound of the wind, and that's all. There's a beauty in that. You can hear the birds now. In the evening, there's hardly a sound at all. Silence. The happiness of silence is so beautiful. And so when you go home, you find you don't want to listen to music so much. You turn off the TV. Totally happy just being in quietness. You're starting to find out another type of happiness, which most people don't realize exists. Which means that when you do have some time off, you don't go watching movies. You just go out to a forest or to a beach or some place where you can find some quietness. And that is not only happiness, that is so profound when you go into a quiet place where nothing moves. Silence and stillness is great happiness. And it's a shame that in our modern world, every place where there's some silence, we put noise. Every place where there's emptiness, like I keep saying, on the great mountain tops of the world, the first thing a person does when they go on top of the mountain is put a flag on it. They spoil the emptiness. It's as if like the emptiness is too much of a challenge for them. They've got to put something there. And the flag comes first of all, and a few years later comes the restaurant. So people can eat their dinner on top of a pristine mountain. Oh, what sacrilege that is. So when you realize the happiness of silence instead of the happiness of noise, then you find you don't think so much. Through insight and understanding, the silence in your mind is more delightful than thinking. Most of your thoughts are not to solve problems, not because you have to work out something. 99% of your thoughts is just wasting time. Thinking about stupid things, fantasies, plans which will never happen, memories which are already finished and you cannot change anyway. Most of your thoughts are just a waste of time. Every now and again there's some decent thoughts which is worth thinking, but most of them are just a waste of time. Why do we think so much? How can we stop that thinking? Or rather, not stop it, but transcend it. is when you start noticing through your insight, between every thought there is a space, a gap, when one thought has finished and the next thought has yet to start. The silence, just like the silent moments between my words. And in those gaps of silence, you weren't thinking at all. It's one of those little tricks we use. There it is again. To show what silence is. And that you can be silent so easily by watching the space between the words, the gaps between the thoughts. Doesn't that feel good? And once you notice how pleasant silence is, you also notice how unpleasant it is to think. As I said, that I did a 6-month silent retreat once, and after the retreat everybody wanted to know what had happened. I had to talk again, and that was so difficult, thinking. I stopped thinking for weeks, and now I had to think again. I had to literally force my mind, my brain, to start thinking. It just didn't want to do it. What happened, Ajahn Brahm? Not much. And because everybody was asking me, I forced my mind to start thinking. And literally, I had a headache for 3 days. Just forcing your brain to actually, out of compassion for other people. But it's so nice not to think. Silent. And is that being stupid? Absolutely not. It's being wise in silence. It's in silence you see the truth of things, not through the words. Just like I did a simile of the toilet door at Dhammasara. This is my last story in the Good Bad Who Knows book. There was a philosophy professor. Now, where can I say he comes from this time? Okay, from Melbourne? Yeah, philosophy professor. Oh, you're from Ohio. From Ohio. I told you, I went to Ohio from Youngstown. He's a philosophy professor from Youngstown, Ohio. And he heard that there was one of these French chefs, Michelin 5-star rated chef, was visiting Ohio to set up a restaurant. And this professor of philosophy loved his food. So immediately found out from the newspapers there was a 5-star French restaurant opening up in town. He rang up to make a reservation. But even by then, it was hard to get on an Ajahn Brahm retreat to get a reservation in this restaurant. They said, you'd have to wait for 2 months. That's the first opening. 2 months? You've just opened up. Yeah, 2 months. There's a big list in front of you. He said, okay, I'll take it. So 2 months went past. And when you go to one of these fine restaurants, you can't just wear jeans and a t-shirt. You have to dress up. It's dress code. I've had great fun with dress codes in my life. My favorite story about dress codes, absolutely true. I don't know how many years ago we had the Commonwealth Games, and Queen Elizabeth II came to Australia to open the Commonwealth Games. At the same time, there was an interfaith service in St. Andrew's Cathedral, Anglican Church in Sydney, so I got an invite to that. And after the invite, there was another invitation came from the then Prime Minister, John Howard, to attend a state dinner in the Grand Hall of Parliament House in Canberra, in the presence of Queen Elizabeth, Prince Philip, and all the dignitaries of Australia. I scored an invite to a state dinner. Wow. And I showed it to the other monks here at the time. Should I go? I said, yeah, you must go. It's acknowledging Buddhism. But then I looked on the invitation, that really nice invitation card. This is not just an invitation to go to McDonald's for a birthday party. This is really fine stuff. So when I looked at the invitation card, there's a problem. Big problem, dress code. This is with Queen Elizabeth. You can't just turn up in anything. Okay, what's the first option? There's three options. The first option was black tie. And straight away, because I don't know these things. I've been a monk for over 40 years. So I thought, is that all you have to wear? No shirt, no trousers, just a tie. That's what it said, black tie. But then they told me that's code. Code means a suit, nice shoes, and a black tie with it. Okay. We don't have any of that in our monastery. We don't have even one tie in the monastery. I can't go there. What's the second? The second option was military uniform. I'm a monk. Pacifist. We can't wear like army uniform or navy. So that was out. And I looked at the third option and my eyes lit up. I said, yeah, I can go as that. And the third option was long dress. That's the way I went. This is long dress. So I actually went there. I rocked up there with all these other people. I was in the toilet with Lachlan Murdoch. I was kidding myself. I didn't have a donation envelope to hand over to him. Richard's and members. Anyway, before I got in there, security took me aside. Are you supposed to be in here, sir? So I got me and said, yeah, look, invitation's my name. Okay, and you get. So that's a dress code which sometimes you have. Anyway, back to the restaurant. This professor dressed up really nicely. And we went to the restaurant and have these things people call maitre d's. And now, can I see your ID, sir? Gave him the ID. Okay, sir, you've got a reservation. Please come inside. And they led him to his table. Now, this was not just an ordinary restaurant. This was exquisite. Just the decor, just the way everything was laid out. They had these standard lamps, these little big table lamps. So it wasn't too dark, but not too light. But it was just subdued light, just to give you the sense of privacy, intimacy, but so you could see your food, but other people really couldn't see you. And the tables were this beautiful, rich mahogany. Silver cutlery on there. And they led him to his seats, took the seat out for him, and pushed the seat in for him, beautifully upholstered, very comfortable. This was high class. And then the waiter came to give him the menu. And this waiter was like an English butler, with the tails and a beautiful bow tie, beautifully groomed hair, and very eloquent when he gave the menu to the professor. And the professor said, thank you. And the professor looked at that menu and admired the quality of even the writing on the menu. It was like calligraphy. It should be in some museum somewhere with a beautiful gold border and on the paper was like parchment. It was really high quality. So the professor said, thank you for the menu. And then the professor looked at the menu and ate the menu until the menu was no more. He ate all of it. He ate the menu, the paper, and then paid his bill and left. Because the professor didn't know the difference between the menu and the food. And that is why some people don't understand insight. They don't know the difference between the thoughts, that's the menu, and what those thoughts are pointing to, that's the reality. Please don't confuse the thoughts with the reality. I don't know if I told this story already, told it recently somewhere. Was that the of Lao Tzu I think I did the first night, going for the walk up into the mountains, and the student was with him on the walk. They're supposed to keep noble silence, and the student said, "What a beautiful sunset." He broke the rule, and so I got punished. And why? What's wrong with saying what a beautiful sunset? If you think what a beautiful sunset, you're not seeing the sunset anymore. If you go outside, sit on the stupa, and you think beautiful trees, you're not seeing the trees anymore. You're seeing the thoughts. Totally different. That is why only in silence is there truth. In the thoughts, there's distortions. So, that's why silence is such an important thing if you're going to get insight. It's not the words. The word toilet doesn't mean you urinate on the door. It's pointing to where the toilet is inside. When you go to the restaurant, you don't eat the menu. The menu is pointing to the food. So it points you there, so I'll take that one, and then the food comes to you. Eat the food, not the menu. Even the thoughts which come in the mind, they're just pointing to something. I'll now give you a nice little exercise. I want you now just to, you don't need to close your eyes, you can keep them open if you like, you can close them in if you like, but I just want you to be mindful of your reactions in this little 2-minute exercise. I'm going to say a word. I want you to see what happens in your mind after I say the word. Peace. 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 That's enough. After I said the word peace, after a few repetitions, maybe after the first or a few other repetitions, your mind started moving towards peace. The word was just the signpost. But automatically your mind started to feel the peace, experience what that word is pointing to. And after a while you don't need the word anymore. Peace. You have peace. That's one of the reasons why people, they don't even understand loving kindness or love. They understand the word. But they haven't paused in silence long enough to understand what that word means. We'll try it. Love. 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 Don't think it, feel it. Love. 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 You getting into it? Now you understand how insight works. When we have a thinking mind and naming mind, we spoil everything. We can use that thinking mind, but we don't obsess in it. Once we see what's there, we don't need to think anymore. Which is one of the reasons why we do this meditation, calming the mind down, watching the breath. After a while, you know, people start off with in, out, in, out, in, out. You don't need to say those words anymore. You can feel what it is to go in. You feel what the breath is. You feel it yourself. You understand it. You experience it. And once you can start to experience just the physical feeling without a name, that's actually what you learn in walking meditation. You're walking, hopefully many of you have been walking backwards and forwards until the body does the walking. That's one of the nice stages of walking meditation. You walk backwards and forwards. I didn't decide to lift my leg. Did it by itself. I didn't decide to turn around. It becomes totally automatic. As many, many, many years ago when armies used to march instead of going in trucks. When they used to march, they sometimes would march all night, you know, to get to the front line or wherever their general wanted them to be. And they would actually go to sleep while they were marching. They'd be fast asleep, but they would be still walking as they were marching. As if the body would do it automatically. body just let go. And they were having a rest, but they were still walking all the time. And this is sometimes what happens, not exactly the same, not falling asleep when you're walking meditation, but you're watching and I'm not doing anything. The body's doing the walking and I'm just like this person who's not involved at all, which is a wonderful experience of just how you can let go. And the body still walks. You just watch it. You don't give any instructions at all. You're becoming silent and you know what it means to move, to walk. Not as a word, but as an experience. And that's what happens with even breathing and also just the delight which comes up. We also realize, just from our own experience, the happiness. What is happiness? The thing which we're always looking for. Yeah, you get the happiness of getting your favorite food, or the happiness of seeing your favorite movie. Alas, Star Wars, yes, you sit down, you got it on the movie, on your TV, yes, I'm really looking forward to this. Whatever it is, but that's not real happiness. All the different happiness you have in life, which one would you want if you had only one choice? And sometimes when you've had it really big experiences, you find it's contentment. Just there are those times. I like to have this little exercise for people. Can you remember the happiest moments of your life so far? Just choose one of them. When you're really, really, really happy. And most times that would be a time of deep contentment, where you were with somebody you love and care for, or maybe just by yourself. You had this feeling, I don't want to be anywhere else in the whole world except right here, with the people around me. May not be the best, but this is more than good enough. Moments when you can just listen to the wind and you don't want it to stop. When you can just be sitting here and you don't want anything to be changed. Times of total contentment, at ease and peace. The happiest moments of your life. Contentment. And after a while, that's what I've always found. The times when I want things, have to do things, that's not happiness. But the time I can just sit down, either in meditation or just sitting in my cave doing nothing. As I say, sitting on the stoop or just watching the trees grow in the morning. I call it watching the trees grow because sometimes if you sit there and you're not doing anything, your partner comes up to you and says, what do you do, darling? Say, nothing. Oh, great, come and help me. We don't respect the art of doing nothing as something to be... Oh, you're doing nothing. Oh, carry on. Instead, we think it's just copping out, so you're doing nothing, which means you're free, come and help me. So I tried that before, even as a monk. What are you doing, Ajahn Brahm? I'm doing nothing. Oh, great, can you come and help me? So I never say I'm doing nothing anymore. I say I'm watching the trees grow. Oh, what? So have some sort of word, some technique, which looks like you're doing something, but actually you're doing absolutely nothing. You're just relaxing. So I use that word. You can use it yourself. You know, you're in the garden at home and your wife asks you, oh, can you come and help me do something? Say, sorry, darling, I'm watching the trees grow. And they do grow, but you've got to be very patient, otherwise you miss it. That's just an excuse for celebrating the art of doing nothing. And then you find that that is happiness. You're learning what is real happiness in life. And once you learn that through the insight in meditation, you will find you live a much more peaceful life. You don't do so much. You're not like these people in the world running around like chickens with their heads cut off, running this way, running that way. Do you complain about how busy life is? If you do, why? You're busy too. Can you not slow down? I don't know how to slow down. It's because we don't appreciate the happiness. The sheer pleasure of doing nothing. We keep thinking because we know nothing else. But once you listen to the silence, recognize the silence, cultivate the silence, delight in the silence, you find even in your life you don't think so much. You're quiet much more. But I need to solve problems. Problems are solved in silence, not through thinking. And what was it last September? I gave the keynote address at the 2015 World Computer Congress in front of all these big executives from Google, from LG was in Korea, Samsung obviously. And there was a Buddhist monk who knows so little about computers giving a keynote address at the 2016 World Computer Congress for Satya Computing. What was I doing there? And I was teaching people how to innovate and get insight. And what I did, I got up as a bottle of water. This is how I taught these executives and lots of ministers and stuff how to innovate through insight, how to solve problems. What is this? I asked the audience. So I said, a bottle of water. Keep on looking. What else do you see? Say, plastic. What else do you see? They say, blue top. What else do you see? Say, about, 200 liters? What else do you see? Keep on looking. What else do you see? What do you see? What else? What else? You understand that we give things names. Once all the names are exhausted, then you can start to see things. Once all the thoughts stop, because all your thoughts is what you've learned at school and in life. Bottle, water, plastic. That's what you've learned. That's not insight. Once all those thoughts have been exhausted, now you can start to see things. That's insight. And also, in areas like computing and IT, this is where you get new ideas. Look long enough to exhaust everything you've ever known and been taught, all the thoughts, and then you can see. This is insight into whatever this is. Insight into you. Understanding who you are. For goodness sake, look long enough to all the thoughts vanish. Everything you've ever been told who you are. Everything you've ever assumed from life. Usually told by other people what you are. And then what you think you are. Allow all of that to disappear. And then you may have insight into the silence, who you really are. And the answer to that question will be explained to you tomorrow, the same time, the same place, in the next episode of The Path to Enlightenment. Da da da. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. I have fun.